Hello, dear listeners. This is the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest is poet, teacher, screenwriter, Tom C. Hunley. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Accents.
Thanks for having me, Katerina.
Your latest book is The Loneliest Whale in the World. It recently came out of Terrapin Books. As soon as I saw the announcement, I knew I had to have it. Talk to us about this book, please.
This book is the kind of the follow-up to the Rattle chapbook, Adjusting to the Lights. The chapbook was, chapbooks tend to be all on more or less one subject, which was adoption of a teenage girl and the raising an autistic son. So all the poems in chapbook were about that. I kept some of those, and along with some newer poems on those subjects, along with other subjects. The title is an autism metaphor, the way I use it anyway.
Please describe the cover image and tell us how you chose it.
Yes, the artist Michael Kretsch has an entire series called At the School for Special Children. And so the publisher, Diane Lockwood, knew this artist or knew his series. And when she saw the subject matter of my book, she thought something from that series would work. And she gave me a whole bunch of his artworks to choose from. And I chose this one. It's got some children flying outside of what looks like an orphanage. Mm-hmm. So it's not on the nose, but it's on a similar topic to my subject matter being special children, among other things.
I would love to hear several poems.
Sure. Well, also, like I said, there are other subjects here also. Several of the poems are just about aging and the body. I'll just read one of those. This is called 50, and as the title indicates, I wrote it when I was turning 50.
I have a birthday tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you what, but it's above that.
There we go.
Yeah.
50. All morning, I gather the parts of me. A wedding ring lodges beneath a swollen knuckle. At least I'm not in one of those old bodies that chases young bodies, a bird that doesn't recognize the window between himself and that sweet parakeet. On the other hand, my other hand writes and remembers how to grip a tennis racket. My feet search for socks to cram themselves into, like songs into 3 radio-friendly minutes. My mouth is an open door, my throat a foyer, my belly a rec room. Bring more chairs, more chairs. Earlier, my ear tried to alert me to a new way to disappear, but it was fooling itself. I'm a noise that's not going anywhere. At least my eyes have stayed in my head, which at least has held onto some hair. Once a year, I give blood like a Christmas present I hope to get back. Aches ride up and down the elevator of my body, unsure what floor to settle on. Read the label. Side effects may include loss of speed, memory, and parents. My students ogle their phones rather than watch me come apart like a cloud of smoke. I tell them to savor each breath the way an alcoholic savors the last shot in the bottle. Class, 1 minute you're playing egg toss, the next minute you're the egg.
Love it. I would love to hear a son poem, a daughter poem, and a wife poem. On your website, I read that you're a family man obsessed with writing about family.
Sure, you bet. Here's one of the newer poems about my daughter. I just saw it. It's called Adopting a Teenager Via State Foster Care. We want a daughter, we say. We have a girl, say the ladies with clipboards. She's about to be hit by a bus. She's been in many wrecks. She's always got a break or a bruise. She's about to be hit by a bus, we echo. The ladies with clipboards point at a teen girl, arms outstretched towards an advancing bus. We run to her. We wrap ourselves around her. We can't stop the bus. It hits all 3 of us. We wake in the hospital. We're your parents now, we smile. I hate you, she says. That bus was my boyfriend. He buys me stuffed animals. He says he loves me and would never hurt me. He photoshopped our faces over a bride and groom, and he'll be sneaking in my bedroom window at night. We've got ourselves a daughter, we say.
Wow.
And right before that in the book is one of my son poems, The Last Time I Took My Son to the Movies. We saw Wonder, the story of a boy named Augie with a facial deformity caused by Treacher-Collins syndrome, who gets bullied until the other kids get used to his face and learn to see past it into his beautiful, true self. My son started talking too loud. I knew his whole script. Our car has 162,900 miles on it. I saved $304. I'm buying a leaf blower, some extension cords, some button-down shirts. They're remodeling my high school. They're putting in straight halls because people get lost in the circular halls. They should study the interactive map like I do. How long will this movie take? The man in front of my son turned and said, "Shut up." My son's face reddened. He rocked back and forth, said, "You shut up. I'll call the police on you," as the man tried to lock eyes with him. I leaned forward and said, "Turn around, man." The man and I locked eyes with the fiercest looks we could muster. This lasted forever, a minute maybe. We locked eyes for so long that my mind wandered. Will Augie make friends? What is making that squeaking sound in my Toyota? Should I take it to a mechanic? Who is AC/DC singer before Bon Scott? The man pointed at my son and said, "One more time." I said, "Let's go right now." And he finally turned back to the screen where Augie's dad was telling him to take off his space helmet and face this world and the other children staring at his face. 10 minutes later, my son was still upset, saying, "I'll wreck you, and you don't do that." The man turned again. I leaned forward again, said, "Look, my son has special needs. We're watching a movie about accepting people with special needs." And my son said, "I have autism." The man said, "Okay, you should have said so before." And he was right. He and his daughter found other seats. By the end of the movie, I felt bad for the man. He didn't know about my son, and we don't know what he might live with. His father, newly dead, like Malcolm Young at age 64, unable to remember the songs of his own heart, his job just lost, and him wondering when he could afford to take his daughter to the movies again. I wanted to take him out for a beer. I would have listened to him talk about his father and his daughter. I would have tried to help him find a job. But after that movie, I couldn't find that man among the faces adjusting to the light coming on.
What I hear in your poems, all your poems, and that's why your chapbook, Adjusting to the Lights, and this full length had me in tears every time I read them, is the compassion. And the compassion that is invoked through showing, not telling, or maybe there is some telling and some showing at appropriate places. How does one live with compassion without compassion killing them?
Yeah, that's good. You have to have compassion on yourself too, don't you? We have to learn how to be kind to ourselves as well as being kind to other people, and that's maybe the hardest.
Please read us more poems.
Okay, one more poem. You asked for one about my wife, so here's kind of a love poem for Relena. Love me gentle, firm, the way firemen love a treed cat. Love me when I'm world weary, when I feel like anyone who loves me must be wrong. When I tell you that you're mistaken, that I'm a mistake. Love me when I feel like I'm simultaneously a door with no handle and the frightened thing that can't find its way out. Love me with your hands like I'm all the money you can grab, with your mouth like it's happy hour, drinks half off, with your whole body which feels like a river when I feel like a fish, several hooks in me like prized scars. Love me by kissing my scars. Love me on your hands and knees like a tatterdemalion on a desert island scooping up a bottle with a message in it. Let your love for me be uncharted, unchartable, off the charts. Love me blind as justice. Love me blinder than a gigantic roosting bat satisfied with 1,000 mosquitoes in its stomach. Love me in golden afternoon light, in the darkness behind your eyelids, behind your sleep mask. Love me in every room in your house, in every note of every song you write. Love me like I'm a bookmark holding your favorite page in your favorite book. Love me when I spill beer on the book I borrowed from you and sheepishly return it. Love me until your love for me makes the ceiling spin, makes you sweat cold, makes you need to lie down, makes your head pound, until you swear you'll never love me this much ever again, but then you do.
Love shall save the world, right?
Beauty will save the world, right? Who said that?
I think that it will be love, though, because love can make anything seem beautiful.
I got a t-shirt from Image Magazine that said, "Beauty will save the world." And it was a quote from somebody, I don't remember.
Like, our listeners can look it up, but true. I seem to remember from my communist upbringing that it was Chekhov who said, "У человеке все должно быть красивое." И лица, и одежды, and so, which in translation in English means in a person everything must be beautiful. The face, the clothes, the thoughts, the everything.
Wow. Yeah, well, Chekhov says it. He shouldn't say anything else.
And unless that wasn't Chekhov, but somebody else.
Oh.
Our listeners can look it up and let us know if we got it right.
True.
And if we got it wrong, just don't let us know. What were you doing when you found out that you won the Rato Chapok Award?
It was the middle of the night. It was 2:30 in the morning. I was getting up to pee, and I checked my email.
Yeah? And then? What did you go back to sleep, or you couldn't?
I think I woke my wife up and told her about it.
Uh-huh. And was she mad or happy?
She was happy. She celebrated with me.
Oh, that's great. That book got a lot of attention, didn't it?
I couldn't believe it, yeah. Their marketing plan is brilliant. You know, they have three winners for their contest every year. They have three issues of the journal. They shrink wrap them together and send them to all the subscribers. All the people that enter the contest become subscribers, so they just keep building their subscriber base. So 8,000 plus people got my book all at once, which is an unheard of number for poetry.
Yes.
And I got so many emails and letters, and it was just wonderful. Got my 15 minutes of poet fame, you know.
How did it feel?
Well, it was really great. I had a lot of great conversations, you know. First, I heard from several of my personal favorite poets saying nice things about my poems, and I couldn't believe that. People I'd been reading for 20 years wrote to me, you know. And then also I got emails and some actual letters from people who were social workers, people who were adoptees, people who had adopted, people who had siblings with autism, you know. So just a lot of people that maybe didn't know as much poetry but were interested in the topics I was writing about. So that was also very gratifying. I've always wanted to write poems that people would read outside of our poetry cult, you know. There's this really, poetry has its passionate followers, you know, and they're my people. But I want to bring more people into the fold, you know. I want to write populist poetry. So it was really great to hear from people that aren't always reading poetry.
Well, the moment that you say 8,000 people, then you're outside the cult.
I think so, yeah. That's probably more than the poetry world has in it.
In several countries combined. I will ask you in a few minutes about screenwriting and film producing.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to ask you about writing in series, because you do that. You write on a topic and then you have a book, and then you write on another topic and you have a book. And the first time that I interviewed you, you pulled out those poems that I found so delightful, and they were the Simpsons book. That's what I called them, because I can't remember the...
It ended up being called The State That Springfield Is In.
Ah, okay. So tell us about that book.
Sure. I was just applying for a sabbatical, you know, and to go on a sabbatical, you have to have a project, you have to have a proposal, you know. But I wanted to rest also, because sabbatical, you know, that comes from the word Sabbath. You're supposed to rest. So I thought, what's work and also restful? I thought, well, TV, but writing poems about TV. And I'd been teaching a class on where we read several books of poetry that were pop cultural. One was Denise Duhamel's Kinky, which was all poems about Barbie. Every poem featured a different Barbie. And then we read one called Midlife Crisis with Dick and Jane by Nin Andrews, and they were all poems in the voices of characters from 1950s readers, see Dick Rhyme, Why Can't Johnny Read, you know, they had a dog named Spot. These really simple sentences that were used to teach children to read, but she made a whole poetry world out of this limited vocabulary, and the book was about midlife crisis, but also it was about the change in America from the 1950s till when the book was published. So I had, and there's some other pop culture books I had in my head too. God Save My Queen by Daniel Nestor, which was all poems about the rock band Queen, a lot of footnotes and whatnot. So I just was brainstorming, what do I know well that's in pop culture that I can make a series out of. And I thought, well, I'd seen a lot of episodes of The Simpsons, so I gave it a try. You know, there are 200 characters, so plenty of voices. And I think I ended up publishing 40 poems. I wrote more than that, but I just kept writing until it became really started to feel like work, you know. And I didn't want to watch the show anymore because I was starting to get tense when the show would come on because it felt like work. It's not as easy as it might sound because, I mean, these are recognizable characters. People know how they talk, their catchphrases and everything. People know their biographies, fans of the show, you know. So I didn't want to make mistakes, you know. But I wanted to find, I mean, I recognized I was already relating to these different characters in different ways. So I thought, well, in each poem I'll write in the character's voice, but I'll write about my issues as much as possible. And maybe it's, I'll find the overlap between me and the character.
The voice I found remarkable because it was poignant, personal, political, and hysterical at the same time. I don't know how you did it.
Well, you know, I was standing on the shoulders of the Harvard-educated writers that write this series, for one thing, you know, so I wasn't starting with a blank piece of paper. I was starting with fully developed, very interesting and fun and smart characters and their biographies and their verbal tics, and just trying to add my own, like I said, to find the overlap between the characters and myself and see what I can come up with. Like, for example, the bartender Mo has different sides to his personality, very different sides, and so I do too. So I use that as a way to write about my different sides of my personality. There's the newscaster who's afraid that he's going to be forgotten. His catchphrase is, "You may remember me." But he says that all the time because he's really afraid people are going to forget him, I think. And so I think all poets feel that way. So it was easy for me to use his voice to talk about being afraid of being forgotten. And so on and so on.
And then there is the book Here Lies.
Right. That's another project book. One day I cut myself while doing the dishes, and not badly, but there was a little bit of blood. And I thought, well, what if I had hit my different vein, you know? What if it were more serious? You could die. And then I thought, well, maybe every day something happens that in theory you could die from. So then I started writing poems. Here Lies Tom C. Hunley, who died, and it'd just be a different way of dying. And I'm kind of hoping that, you know, after almost 50 of those, when I do die, hopefully one of those poems will be prophetic. Some of them will not, I'm sure, because there's ridiculous things. Like I get killed by gangsters in one. I get killed by zombie students, former students of mine turned to zombies in one. Some of them are more believable. I hope they don't happen. I die in a mosh pit, at a punk rock show because I jump and off the stage and nobody catches me in one. I'm jogging and I'm killed by muggers in another one, and so on and so on.
And what was the unlikely ones?
The more unlikely ones were like zombies, you know. There's one where I just kind of go down the drain in the shower somehow. For, you know, that's entirely unlikely.
How do you come up with those things?
Well, you know, in that case, I was working on that project. So every day, I mean, I, you know, poets, I think, have all this anxiety about the blank page. Where's my next poem going to come from? So every day I knew I just had to look around and try to find some possible or impossible way to die. And so if something would happen that day, and the one day, I mean, I guess it was implausible, but I was like, I was just in the shower thinking about, you know, my project. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know. I'm watching the soap go down the drain. I thought, well, what if I went down the drain like that? Kind of an odd thought, but I just rolled with it. Another time I was just in the library. So instead of saying how I died, I just said, Tom C. Hunley, your life, Tom C. Hunley died in the library. And so on, like that.
What did Relena think of this more morbid poem, so to say?
Yeah, I think she thought it was kind of morbid. And I felt that way, too. After a couple of years, I just couldn't do it anymore. I did just pick up Here Lies the other day, just looked at some of the poems, and I'm still very proud of them. I mean, that book came out 6 years ago, but I feel like they really held up, you know? There's a sequence of sonnets in there that I'm particularly proud of, where they're kind of collage based. I mean, I took favorite lines and images from other poems and put them together and then gave them a rhyme scheme to make sonnets. So they're very imagistic, and they move. They have a lot of free associations, or seem to. But again, because of the way they're put together through collage.
And not only collage, you sometimes work in erasures.
So you sure a couple.
So what am I holding in my hand now?
Abridged erasure poems. This is my abridged dictionary, 26 poems made from an erasure of the dictionary, you know, trying to find the narrative within the dictionary, trying to find the hidden narrative, the hidden poetry, you know, lots of rhymes, lots of word plays and internal rhymes and alliteration and so on, but just made from, you know, erasing most of the words in the dictionary to make a smaller dictionary.
You also have written craft books.
Yes. While I was still in graduate school, I was studying with Wendy Bishop. My minor was rhetoric and composition, and I was fortunate because Wendy was a leader in rhetoric and composition, but she had also written several creative writing pedagogy books, and her doctorate was in rhetoric and composition, but her master's was in creative writing. And actually, she and I were in a small poetry writing group that would meet in a coffee shop. And so she encouraged me when I had to write a paper for her class. She said it was okay to write about creative writing pedagogy, a little off the topic for the class. But I found some connections between rhetoric and poetry and just ran with them and actually wrote two books and edited a collection. They were all kind of based on the same idea.
What about the Poetry Gymnasium?
The Poetry Gymnasium was the second book that kind of came from that same idea. These five areas of rhetoric: invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery, which I thought could easily apply to poetry. And it turned out that historically, people had studied poetry that way. So invention is in speech writing, you know, it's just where you come up with ideas. It's what we call pre-writing, you know. Arrangement is, for poetry, would be form and structure. Style, you know, is things like figurative language, and also registers. You know, are you writing in a high style or a low style or a medium style? Memory was two things. What are some ways to make poems more memorable? And I learned that there have been a lot of studies saying a couple things. You know, one, rhyme and meter make poems more memorable. Also, strange imagery. People use strange images as mnemonic devices. So if you want to make your poem memorable, put strange imagery in it. But also there's some stuff in there about memorizing poetry and why that's important. And then delivery, which traditionally was for people that give speeches, how do you deliver your speeches? You know, how do you use your hands? How do you use your face? How do you control your voice? But for print also, it's what font do you use, things like that. So anyway, I just saw that these five areas that people of instruction in rhetoric, they all seem to apply to poetry. So that I made those books based on that one idea.
It seems to me that relatability also helps poems be remembered. Like, okay, here lies Tom Hanley, right? You know, we're all gonna die. And he's giving examples, and that's relatable. And, you know, I've remembered it over the years. And I've read some of these poems, which I found, again, poignant, hysterical, personal, and memorable, and relatable.
Thank you.
What are you writing these days?
Okay, so not that much. You know, I'm just hoping to get started here with the Lexington Poetry Month, which started a couple days ago, and I have posted poems, but I've been cheating. I posted, you know, other poems that I needed feedback on. You're supposed to write a poem a day, so I'm going to get on that and see what happens.
I plan to post a poem saying something resentful about the people who have pre-written their poems. When you read it, know that it's not about you and that I have already written my poem.
Well,
yesterday.
I can't wait to read it. I read your one that you posted, I think, yesterday. It was just about, it was like a clearing your throat poem.
Yeah, it's like, I did this.
And I'm working on screenplays, as you know, also.
Yes, tell us about that.
I'm on a grant now. I don't know if I told you this. I got an $8,000 grant to make my second short film.
Congratulations.
And it's based on two of my poems from Adjusting to the Lights. So it's going to be very autobiographical. Some of the same actors that were in my first short film are going to be in it. It's going to be filmed in August.
That's great. Tell us about the previous film that was produced.
The first film was based on Clint Margrave's novel, and you know Clint.
Yeah.
His novel is called Lying Bastard, which I didn't think would work as a title for a short film, you know. It's called You're Not Alone. In his novel, the main character is a professor named Berlin Saunders, who I related to very much. And Berlin is he's suffering from a bout of writer's block and imposter syndrome. He feels like he's not a good teacher because he's not doing much writing, and he feels like he's just going through the motions. He's starting to have suicidal ideas. And in his head, he's workshopping the ideas. He keeps working on a suicide letter in his head. And I thought it would be interesting if he actually called a suicide hotline. And so I created a character that works at a suicide hotline. And in a sort of a satire of the workshop process, she figures out that if she tells him his letter's no good, he'll stay alive, and he'll keep calling with revisions. So that's what happens until he accidentally calls the wrong number because he's been drinking. And he calls a sex hotline. That's another character that I invented, Jennifer, whose name sounds like Genesis, the suicide hotline worker. And there's a mistaken identity thing. And he thinks he's talking to Genesis. And since she's being so positive and saying, good, good, that she's trying to tell him to kill himself. And that really calls his bluff. He realizes he doesn't want to die and hangs up the phone. He thinks he's hanging up the phone on the suicide hotline worker, but it's on the sex hotline worker. He puts a gun to his head and... Well, he gets inspired. He gets the inspiration for a novel about a character named Clint Margrave, who's the star of a novel by Berlin Saunders called Lying Bastard. So it's a little meta there. And, partly it's fan fiction. I want people to read Clint's novel. And also, I just identified so much with the character and had some ideas. So it's, I hope I did justice to the... to the novel, and it is about to be at its second film festival, the Imaginarium Festival here in Lexington.
Awesome.
July 19th through 21.
I haven't read Clint's novel.
It's hilarious and dark. It's darkly
His
humorous.
His poems are dark and humorous, yeah. So I can't wait to read it.
It's basically suicide jokes, and oh that's God, the spirit yeah. of the movie.
Well, the movie was fabulous. What does Clint think of the movie?
Oh, well... What does he think?
what did he tell you that he thinks about the movie?
I didn't get his comments on later drafts. On early drafts, he said it was pretty much in the spirit. You know, there was a feature length screenplay, and he actually gave me some critiques on drafts of it. You know, I had a bunch of endings that weren't right, and he told me why they weren't right. I think he likes it. I hope he does. And then the second short film is going to be called Awesomistic. And it's based on two poems about my son, just based on a couple times as a teenager when he had meltdowns in public and people didn't understand what was going on, and they thought they were tantrums, and that they thought they were witnessing bad parenting. So in the script, the first time this happens, the dad sort of cowers and gets the kids out of there and doesn't stand up for his son. And the second time, it's actually the second incident is based on the poem I just read about the movies. The dad has a breakthrough and sticks up for his son, and it's sort of the resolution of the film. But I'm really hoping that, I know a lot of people won't read poetry, so I'm hoping that some of those people will see a movie, and I do feel like there's still a need for more understanding of autism. You know, people need to get better at recognizing the difference between a tantrum and a meltdown, among other things.
Yeah. You brought us a poem here to read.
Sure, I do. I have one new poem to read. It's kind of long. It's called The Dad Joke, and it's after Patricia Lockwood. Do you know her poem about 10 years ago? She had a poem called The Rape Joke that went viral. It was her... She basically got famous from that poem, but I kind of got the idea for the structure of this poem from her poem, The Dad Joke. The first dad joke I remember is my dad saying, "I used to know somebody whose nose was always runny. You may think this is funny, but it's not." It was also the first dad joke I told, 9 years old, on the playground to a kid who had already heard it from his dad. I heard my dad tell it again when I was 49. That's part of what makes it a dad joke. When I was 10, my dad drove away, or my mom drove him away. On Father's Day, one of her bitter single mom friends bought herself a t-shirt that read, "World's Best Dad." I felt for her, but she wore it over and over, and I found it sad and trapped rather than funny, which made it a legit dad joke. Somebody else's dad taught me the word palindrome with the example, "Did I poop? I did." I thought my dad would love that one. "Dad, did I poop? I did, Dad," is also a palindrome, but my dad wasn't around and I never shared it with him. The dad joke was on my dad's girlfriend when she called my house looking for him, and I didn't have the heart to tell her that he was in Vegas marrying his other girlfriend. The first adult advice my dad gave me came in the form of a dad joke. My first serious girlfriend had left me, and he said, "They're like buses. If you miss one, you get on another." The dad joke was on me when I learned that I didn't have any credit because I'm a junior, and Experian docked me by mistake when my dad didn't pay child support. The dad joke was on the collection agency who called me looking for my dad. He lived in Brazil, Indiana at the time, so I said, "My dad's in Brazil." Dad jokes are made of words, but sometimes words fail us, and sometimes our dads fail us. After 20 years out of my life, my dad visited me and my wife in Florida. Overcome, I played Leader of the Band on the jukebox, a song about a son who admired his father and didn't say a word. Without saying a word, my father got up and put Cats in the Cradle on the jukebox, a song about a father's regrets. No joke, that's how we made up, without a word. I am a living legacy. When you coming home, Dad? A dad joke depends on delivery, but in the delivery room, I wasn't prepared for how goopy and pointy-headed my firstborn was, and I'm ashamed that I was ashamed that my first thought was, "He's ugly, but I'll love him anyway." My wife looked at him and said, "He's perfect, a better take." The next day, I met my buddies for cigars, and the dad joke was, "I'm already a better dad than my dad because I'm here for my son." But at that very moment, back in our apartment, my wife changed a diaper and wondered where I was. "Dad, did I poop? I did, Dad." The dad joke is that when I hear someone walking into the room, I pretend I've been talking about them, e.g., "That's why you should always listen to your mom, kids," if it's my wife, or "That's why your sister is my favorite," if it's my daughter. The dad joke is that after I wrote a book about The Simpsons, I started calling all of my son's friends Milhouse. We gave one of the Milhouses our old car, and a week later, the driver of a dump truck fell asleep at the wheel and drove him into a ditch, which is no joke, but maybe an irony. The dad joke is that while he was in the ditch, when I didn't know that he had a concussion and would need brain surgery, he texted me that he was fine, and I texted back, "I don't care about that. How's the car?" The dad joke is when their white friend told me his name was Rico, I nicknamed him Soft Taco because soft tacos are Hispanic but also white. The dad joke is that Soft Taco's dad called me and introduced himself as Sam's dad, which is how I learned that Soft Taco was putting everyone on when he said his name is Rico. The dad joke is that Sam is going to be a teen dad soon, and I think he should name his son Soft Taco Jr. When my sons were middle schoolers, we put together a family band, Dr. Tom and the Mini-Me's. The dad joke is that the boys rebelled by giving up punk rock, that instead of making myself the cool dad, I made punk rock square. One of my sons says that the dad joke is that I just used the word square, which was cringe of me. The dad joke my kids like best is when someone gets personal in an online argument and I type, "Jesus loves you. Everyone else thinks you're an asshole." If you're an asshole and you get cancer, it's colon cancer, no matter what kind of cancer it is another dad joke. Cancer's no joke, but my dad got it. "Can you cut it out?" "I think I can, sir." "No, you probably won't be able to play piano after this," the surgeon told my dad. "A, you'll probably be dead, and B, I know you could never play the piano because I've heard this dad joke before." What do you get when you cross a dad joke with an elegy? Seriously, what? This is not rhetorical. This is not a joke. If you've heard this one before, you know how it ends. Not with a punchline, but a punch in the face. You'll tell your kids that their grandpa's in heaven, or if you're not religious, you may say he's in Vegas or Brazil. Why did the chicken cross the plane from this world to the next? Because he couldn't quite make it across the road. Knock, knock. Who's there? Dad? No one's there. Not funny. At all. One day you ask your dad to subtract 2 from 2 and he says nothing. Okay, subtract 1 from 1, you say, and he says nothing. Okay, but what if you multiply nothing by nothing, you ask, and your dad, all out of jokes at last, says nothing, nothing, nothing. Because it's true, but also because he's disappeared, because he's crossed to the other side, because he's dead, because it gets told with astonishment, with resignation, it gets told with sadness and with regrets, it gets told and retold because it gets old, it gets so very old, like your dad, and because this isn't funny at all, which makes it a legit dad joke.
Wow, Tom, that's nothing short of amazing.
Thank you. I feel good about that one. I saw some things while I was reading it that I'd like to revise, actually, but
all these still a work emotions, in progress. It a roller coaster and a journey at the same time. I have one last question for you, and that is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class, what is it?
I've really been focusing in the last few years on revision. because I do think that that's where writing gets really good, and I think that people that really embrace revision are the ones that are more likely to be pros, and the ones who are too easily satisfied are the ones that are more likely to be amateurs or just doing it for fun, you know. I think we should be reckless with revision. I think we should risk making the poem worse. You know, I mean, I know some people keep every draft, you know. I stopped doing that. I try to be bold about my revisions. Like if I cut something, I don't want to see it again, you know, because I want to replace it with something new. And then cut some things and then replace those with something new. And I've just been really thinking about different how to articulate how to revise also. I wrote an essay a couple years ago. I had a couple dozen different revision techniques. I have my students try out some of those techniques because I think it's hard to teach revision, just like it's hard to do revision. So I'm focusing more on trying to explain my revision practice and trying to practice what I preach, you know. Once I gathered some of these techniques from other people and I've been trying them out and finding a lot of them really great. And so, yeah, although while Lexington Poetry Month is great, you know, write a poem a day, I don't really believe you can write a poem in a day or every day, or I don't really want to work that way. I'm happy to try to write, to draft a poem a day and then maybe spend the rest of the year on those same poems, doing, yeah, even more revision than I've done before. And I hope my students, some of my students seem to embrace that and others have trouble with it.
Reckless with revision. That sounds like a band name.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Tom, for coming on Accents.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always good to see you. It's always good to be here in Lexington and the area, Frankfurt.
See you again with the next book.